You're listening to the Reinvest Podcast, where each Tuesday we will show you how to reclaim, reconnect, and refocus your life by bringing you the top real estate professionals in the industry. We'll pull back the curtain so you can implement these tools and tactics to build generational wealth. Your hosts, Garrett Gatton and Seth Simonillo. Thanks, guys, for joining us on another episode of the Reinvest Podcast, episode 57. If you've been listening here the last few episodes, we've hit a year and a half mark of doing episodes, bringing you top quality guests from all over the country and in our backyard that are just killing it in all things real estate, trying to bring you different strategies, different markets and resources that you can add to your tool belt, and maybe even find some operators that would be great places to put investment capital. So thank you so much for that. Just your feedback's been super valuable to us. And I think it's having an audience base that is committed to grow in real estate is what fuels Seth and I to continue to do this and bring in awesome guests. If you have a guest that you think would be a good fit for our show, we're all ears and want to lean on your network as well. So you can email us or text us and we'll look into it.
And also, if you've enjoyed the podcast, please give us a rating and leave us a review. We will check those, and that helps us know what people like and what people don't like about the podcast.
Yeah. So today's episode here on episode 57 is we're joined with John Totterud. You're in Seattle. Is that right, John?
Yes, I am. Yes.
And you are the principal and founder of Cardinal Oak Investments. You guys are a multifamily acquisition company. Do you do this full time, John?
I do. I do it full time now. Had been in a W-2 job up until about 2 years ago, but I've been fortunate enough to be able to transition into multifamily real estate, which is something awesome that I really enjoy.
Yeah, that's an awesome transition. And I would like to talk about that a little bit later, just how you made that jump. We've talked to a number of people who were doing this kind of as a way either to supplement income, set up retirement, or replace their W-2. And that jump can be scary. It can be a big jump, you know. And so when do you do that? How do you do that? I'd love to get into that, but go back, before we started the show, you had said that you've been investing in multifamily for 13 years. How did you get into real estate?
Yeah. Yes. Thanks, Garrett. I appreciate it. Thanks for the opportunity to share my story. I got into it, quite a while ago when I was owning just my own single family homes, and through a couple opportunities, moved and then rented out the one that I used to live in, and didn't do that for very long, but I could kind of see the benefit. I really had a taste of what renting could really mean and the whole business aspect of real estate investing. And I was thinking about it in the back of my mind. And then around 2006-07 or so, I started taking interest in it, and I started looking around for properties and talking to other friends and thinking about getting into or buying some kind of multifamily property with a friend. And I looked at a lot of properties and even got the financials, drove around to them, and for various reasons at that point in time, I just didn't buy anything. And so 2007, 2008 rolled around, and then the economy, of course, fell apart. And I was super glad that I wasn't into any real estate. Pricing.
You were probably thinking that was a big bullet that you dodged there.
It was. Yes, prices dropped. I mean, if you recall, 30-50% easily, and there are properties that had been refinanced, and now they were, the bank owned them again. They were on the market for so much less than what they'd been refinanced to. So I still was interested. I looked again in around 2009, 2010. And you know, when an economy is coming out of a recession, you never really know, oh, it's hit bottom, now it's starting to move up again. You just don't know that. You kind of feel like, well, it feels like it's been down for a while, and I don't think it's going to go down too much further. So I might as well start jumping in. And that's what I did. And my first property was 2010. And I was thinking of partnerships, but ultimately my first property was one that my wife and I just bought ourselves. It was just a small property near where we lived. And I was the property manager, for better or for worse, and learned the hard way how to do all these little things, do the repairs and write leases and advertise for tenants and figure out all the notice and eviction laws and all that stuff. You don't really, well, in my case, at least I didn't take a bunch of classes in it. I had a lot of business experience and felt that I could figure things out. And I did. I'm little by little. You have a problem, you figure it out. And that's still the case today. I mean, even when you get bigger, you can't be afraid because you've never done this before. You have to dive in. And so feel free to go ahead and jump in.
So what was your career leading up to this during the recession in 2010?
Yeah, it was in information technology. I had been in software development for a while, managing engineers, had my own software company and did software related consulting, like project consulting, and was doing a fair amount of that in a number of different roles. Was at Microsoft for a number of years and some other companies in the area that I was able to consult with.
So what did that look like through the recession for your company, your business? I mean, were things retracting for you, or was there still enough demand in the software sector that you were okay, you kind of kept moving forward, business as usual?
It was contracting for sure. Consulting was tightening up. As lots of us know, in periods of downturn, consultants are the first people that are let go. And my role was still in demand. I didn't have a problem getting consulting roles, but the terms had changed, the durations changed, and certainly there's a willingness to cut somebody loose pretty quickly. And you know, of all the benefits of consulting, and there are a lot. I mean, I really enjoy it. It just look like a wide variety of different types of roles and to perform and projects to do and people to meet. But one of the downsides, of course, is that you can it can end quickly. And I was prepared for that. And that's another driver for wanting to have the autonomy and independence, financial independence, to not have to worry about those things, to be able to choose the things that you want to do. And that was what compelled me to get into real estate and look for things that I could impact and investments that I could control.
I think one of the things that is that I'm excited about to jump in today, John, with your story and for our listeners is when somebody says, hey, I've been in real estate, I feel like probably 75% of the time they started in the last 5 years, right? Because social media is interesting. It has a way to quickly kind of disseminate and distribute ideas and concepts at scale. And that's happened a lot with real estate. It's been a buzzword for people for various factors, right? Because maybe the stock market feels inflated. And so it's just, you know, a good alternative, or people are house hacking. Bigger Pockets has kind of brought real estate investing into everybody's forefront, their foresight. But they don't have the context and the longevity maybe of somebody who's been investing prior to 5 years ago, prior to even 10 years ago, because we've been in the longest, you know, bull market here, so to speak, for lack of better terms. Mm-hmm. And they don't maybe have the context of what does a recession look like. And so I want to kind of use your story and your track record of last 13 years and what you were doing prior to, because even though you weren't actively buying in 2007, 2008, you were looking. And so you had already begun that mindset shift of, I want to do real estate, I'm looking at real estate, back then at the height of the market right before it fell off. So I guess this is a good time just to jump into this and then we'll kind of walk through. So, you know, for our listeners, you can Google this. This is a great little graph to even make sense of what's going on right now in our current economic conditions. The real estate market cycle is this. You know, phase one, you have a recovery period after a recession and, you know, there's no new construction. Vacancy, you know, starts to decrease and occupancy starts to saturate and absorb what's out there in the way of rentals, housing, that creates expansion, which is, you know, phase two. And then that expansion creates demand on the market. And so what happens? Well, then people start building and creating new supply of apartments and single-family housing options for people. Eventually, that supply is completely absorbed, and then the demand lowers, which goes into hypersupply, and eventually, you know, brings us into a recession. So that cycle happens plus or minus, you know, over the course of 7 to 10 years. And, you know, we're in unique times right now, though. So what would you give us some context to 2007, 2008? I know you talked about it a little bit, but what did that feel like? I mean, were you around people who were actively invested in real estate when the market turned? What were the emotions like? What were the deals that you saw? When did you know how to buy?
I had friends in my network who were involved in industries with full-time jobs in these industries that were absolutely affected. There were layoffs, substantial layoffs, particularly around finance and real estate. And I had friends who lost their jobs and took a long time to get their jobs back. And that hits home. It's very, very personal, and you can feel it. I also looked around, I mean, in the major metro areas near where I live, Seattle, Bellevue, there's a lot of construction going on. And through the mid-2000s, a lot of new projects were started. And 2008 hit. Those construction projects just ground to a halt. They're holes in the ground that stayed empty for several years after that. All the equipment was removed, and you just kind of wonder, these really nice areas, like core downtown areas, where there are great plans for a large building and whatever is office or apartments or retail or whatever it happened to be, just stopped, and they couldn't continue it because the banks had to finance it, and they weren't interested in doing that anymore.
Well, to the untrained eye, somebody may not be able to make sense of why, you know, like before I got into real estate, you drive by, you see construction, and you're like, oh, there's good things happening. Mm-hmm. That's very exciting. You don't understand what's driving that construction project. You don't understand the environmental, you know, factors, the economic factors, and how the debt markets are, you know, allowing that capital to be infused into that project for that to happen. You just think, oh, they're building a Chick-fil-A, or they're putting a development over there, or there's, you know, a subdivision that's going in down the street from me. So it would have been kind of eerie to see that stop overnight, especially if you didn't understand what was going on.
Yeah, absolutely. And I fortunately was not exposed to it myself, still had a job, house, and could make my payments, and was not particularly at risk. But, you also asked when you know that it's over and it's time to get back in. And there's no, really no green light out there that says it's safe to get back in the water. And I kind of relate that today's where, you know, back then, you are inundated with news about all the economic catastrophe. There's just a bloodbath. It's awful. And you get that day in and day out, depending on the kind of news that you read. And we see the same thing today. And, you know, if it bleeds, it leads, as they say in the news business. And there's a lot of that going on. And so you can be really influenced by that if you're not careful. And relating to today, there's such an information overload today that we have all become more sensitized, and our filters, our little spidey senses are up, and we're really sensitized to filtering out certain types of news that are not relevant anymore. We hear so much of it, and it's also bad. And so, and it wasn't quite like that back then. 2008, 2009, and into 2010, there was still a lot of problematic situations, particularly in the finance industry. And banks were taking a lot of properties, and banks were not geared up for this. They didn't have a big staff of people there that could take all these properties back, hire property managers. I mean, the first property that I bought in 2010 is a three unit, and it was in a complex of about six or eight other small multifamilies. And we had a little HOA group, and the group of us, we would hire the landscapers and pay the pay certain other fees together. One of the properties, the owner just stopped paying their mortgage and was hiring finding renters and putting renters in there and collecting the rents, and they not paying our HOA dues. And there was nothing we could do. We felt like, oh, we got to get on that bank and force them to sell or something like that. But that just wasn't going to happen.
Wow.
You'd call somebody and there'd be nobody to help you. And there was a lot of that going on. So you had to make your own way through it. If you knew the right people to talk to, and the local brokers were key to this. I made great broker relationships, one in particular that found me short sales and found me the right prices and had an idea. That's how I got into the first couple of these properties, great relationships, and I learned the value of brokers in a market. And I still have a tremendous amount of respect for what brokers do and how knowledgeable they are.
I think what's interesting about what you're saying is, I think when you're at our perspective, looking back and trying to make sense of it, kind of in the history books now, you're like, well, you know, the Great Recession, it's got a name for it now. People have had time to process what went wrong, where it went wrong, why it went wrong, what created that scenario, you know, with some of the subprime loans and the banking failures that even allowed for that to happen. And we see with such clarity now. And we kind of, there's a misnomer that because we understand with clarity what happened then, that we're going to feel that measure of confidence when we go through something that's happening in real time, kind of like right now. Mm-hmm. And so I've talked to investors who were actively buying single family houses through 2009, 10, 11, you know, that post recession, you know, coming through the recession. And we look and we're like, oh, if I could have gone back to then, I'd have bought every house that I could have.
Right. But you got such a good deal. You know what I mean?
And you talk to them, you say that in front of these guys, and they're quick to correct you because they're like, hey, it didn't feel like a good deal at the time. It didn't feel like we didn't know we were stepping into all of this equity because we hadn't realized it yet. It took time for that to happen. I mean, you look at, for those guys that bought single family, multifamily in 2010 and 11, when did they really see the equity? 2017, 2018. And so I think the lesson there is that there's always going to be fear. There's always going to be risk. It doesn't matter what climate you're in. If you think that you're going to have just an understanding of what's going on and feel confident about your decisions, I don't think that that's necessarily the case. So how would somebody then, like applying that today, let's say we see a correction, how would somebody have confidence to move forward?
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. People did have a misperception about the success of investors who stepped into the market at that time period. Because they didn't know, not every deal was a good deal. And there was a misplaced perception that anybody who could fog a mirror could make money in real estate. And there were people who made mistakes and lost money in that time period, even after the recession, for sure. I mean, there's always going to be that way. How you relate it to today's market is you have to be objective and factual, and you have to be thinking about the data and ignoring the nightly news. And it's real important to keep your perspective and to look for things that you've determined are important about metrics. How do you know the market is a certain place along the line? Is it ready to turn? Has it turned yet? Or is it a long way still to recovery? And you know, what I've told people, I talk to a lot of prospective investors, people who are out buying or thinking of buying, and a lot of them are on the sidelines. And when a syndicator like myself takes a deal out to investors, a common response is, I don't think it's the right time. I'm going to wait a little while.
Right.
And the response to that is that when the green light flashes, when everybody says, okay, it's safe to get back into the market, and you can invest your money now, that's probably too late. It's right. Later in the cycle that when there's high confidence, that's not the time. I mean, it still could be a good time. I don't mean to say that you should ignore those particular points in the economic cycle, as you were pointing out, but you should be ready sooner than that. You should be looking at things from a perspective of this is a good market. There are companies that are still hiring. These companies are not going to go away in 2 or 3 years. Mm-hmm. And there is rent growth, a lot less than there was before, but there's rent growth. And I'm looking at whatever, Bureau of Labor Statistics, and I'm seeing job growth. And I'm looking at all these other things. It's a nice market, and this is a good property, and I'm getting in at a good deal. This is something I should move on. Look at the practical things about investing, and not step back because it's a bad time in the economy or anything like that.
And I think if you're investing for the fundamentals, you're going to be okay, even if it is a rough time in the market.
Right.
If you're being smart about it. And over the last few years, what we've seen a lot from people is when interest rates were even 2 and 3%, it was a lot of like, man, things are really inflated right now, so I'm not going to jump in. Prices are too high. It's too inflated. I'm going to wait for prices to cool off. And, you know, so they waited, and now interest rates started rising. So interest rates got to 4, 5, 6%. And people were like, well, interest rates are kind of running up. I don't know if I want to buy yet. So they sat on the sidelines, and now interest rates are 8%. And right. They're still saying the same thing. So at some point people have to decide, you know, maybe when to jump off the ledge, so to speak, yes. And jump in. And if you're investing with the good fundamentals, the interest rate and the price, it's all relative as right. long as the deal works.
Right.
And people get in their head like, oh, it's just too high because that's what they hear on the news. That's what they read in yeah. an article. And it's not factual, like what you were saying. I mean, you got to actually know the market, know what's happening in real estate, and make informed decisions.
And know how to process the information that you're getting, because you can see the headlines. Hey, this syndicator, you know, lost his portfolio in this market, and see things are crashing and falling, and there's clickbait everywhere on YouTube. Everybody wants to catch your attention and be like, why I think the housing market's going to crash 30%. And you're just like, you're just after views, man. You know, like, who knows if yeah. when I get in the video, you're really oh, even sure. thinking that, right? We almost, and it's alarming to me that I do this. I get news, not out of reading articles, but we get news off of headlines. Hey, mm-hmm. I saw this article the other day. I didn't say I read the article. I said I saw the headline of the article, and therefore yes. now I know what it's talking about. So it's kind of alarming. You have to know how to process what you're talking about. And, you know, it was very easy to make money in real estate. It was easier to make money in real estate, you know, 3 years ago, 2 years ago. Okay. It was very forgiving time in the market. And it did a lot of things. First of all, it allowed you to be lazy, potentially. It didn't have to be, you know, operators that had the discipline to continue to operate by those fundamentals did very well. But then the people who got lazy or got in thinking, hey, this is great. And they were more leaning on the market to create good investments versus the discipline on the yes. fundamentals of good investing. They're the ones that are going to have to, you know, kind of reconcile that when things turn. But what I saw is things have become very regionalized, right? So at a macro level, because of monetary policy and things with interest rates across the nation, real estate was a good thing to get into. Now you really have to know the market that you're in, because things have been regionalized from market growth, from, you know, state laws that are being, you know, fluctuating massively depending on your strategy. So you can't just take this blanket approach of like, I should get into real estate. People are buying duplexes. I'm going to buy a duplex. You have to know how to look below the surface and really, you know, be proficient at that. Let's apply that to you guys, to Cardinal Oak Investments. Where are you guys at today? What's your appetite? How are you kind of using those fundamentals to stay out of the headline news, but still move forward with good investments?
Yeah, good question. You have to look at the fundamentals of the property. There has to be a willingness from the seller to compromise in terms of pricing or offer some kind of creative deal. There has to be some other kicker in there. I've read more about people that have that refinanced a deal a year and a half ago, and they had a relatively decent interest rate. And granted, they have a long term left on the mortgage, but they also have the opportunity to assume it. And so if you can get in there with maybe a sub 5% interest rate, assume a proper the loan on a property, and there's still a good amount, a strong loan to value in the property, then that could be a good opportunity. So you have to look at all of those things. And then you're looking, the expenses, operational expenses are mm-hmm. climbing also. You have to be looking at the property taxes most likely going up, insurance most likely going up. Other things like utilities, we've seen utility increases, and it's like, why are you doing this? The inflation rate is really shouldn't be driving all that. But you have to look at all your payroll costs are certainly going up. Yeah. All of those things, and they have to make sense. You can't go in with an assumption of a 5 or 6% rent growth over the duration of right. your ownership. That's just not realistic. It never was, but it's certainly been in a lot of pro formas and a lot of deals that have gone to investors. You've got to keep those things low. That means your opportunities are fewer, and certainly brokers are seeing that. Their business has dropped in half. There are not as many transactions, nearly as many. Your principles are not changing. You are still looking at the same things you were looking at before. You mentioned markets across the country. You're still finding good markets. I would mention also that you see the pattern in emerging markets that it shifts from year to year, even within a year. There's not one market that's reliably always an emerging market. Even in a downturn, you're going to find markets across the country that are strong and are doing well and expected to start outperforming in the next several years. And it's your job as an investor to find them and to target them and to get to know them and look for properties in those markets. It's like a stock market. You see a stock market, and it just declined 2% today, and that's awful, or right. 3 or 4%, we're just got killed. But you look at the stocks that dropped and the stocks that rose, you still find a few that rose. Why did they rise? It's because something else is going on with them. You have to do the same thing in real estate markets and find these emerging markets and be targeting them in the downturn. They're always going to be good markets.
There was somebody that we had interviewed, and I've forgotten they said this, but you marry the principle and you date the strategy. And so, you're always going to be tied to the principles, but you mentioned some shifts in strategy right now in this market, which is loan assumption, seller financing terms, knowing. And so, Bigger Pockets, I think, was always like seller financing, low to no money down. Well, depending on the time that you were kind of hearing that information, it may have been difficult to find a scenario like that. But right now, understanding why is that a compelling strategy for you and for a seller that you should keep in the back of your mind, because that could be a very plausible way to source deals right now. Banks are starting to get a little more strict on their lending guidelines. Maybe their DSCR is a little bit higher. Maybe they want to see that you have more operational history before they're going to underwrite, the deal that you're bringing to them. So, if you can go to a seller who wants a certain price for their property, but they'll work with you on interest rates, that could work.
Especially for a seller who's looked at the last few years and have seen all these high prices, and maybe they just missed the boat in listing their property or unloading it, and they still have that price in their mind.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe it's justifiable, to your point, if you can do some sort of creative financing or a seller carry back, or if they carry the whole note. We've come across a couple of deals like that even in the last 6 months.
Literally, we have done a couple of deals like for ourselves that has been the scenario, and it wouldn't have penciled otherwise. But now they're great deals because there's different levers that you can pull and manipulate, and the debt is one of those things. So John, where were we? Where are we? We talked about that. Where do you think we're going? I know you probably left your crystal ball at home, but give us John's kind of, you know, the data that you see. You had mentioned that you were at the Best Ever conference back in March, and we didn't realize that we were both, like both of us were there during that time, which is kind of funny. But if you remember, the tagline of that was survive till 25, right? That was kind of like the get to 2025, you know, when interest rates can come down a little bit lower. What's your assessment with all that?
I hope that's still a tagline. It doesn't look like we're on a trajectory to be that far out of the woods by 25, but we can still hope. And no, at the Best Ever conference, there were some good speakers. I remember a couple of them, economists that talked about what they're seeing coming out of the Fed. The Fed is a key driver in the real estate market, but it's certainly not the main one. And prognostications about, you know, how many more rate hikes are going to stop in May? Are they going to do another one in July? And now, you know, who knows? The thinking from is that the Fed will not raise rates anymore, will hold steady, but possibly there's another one in December. I don't know. I mean, I read it and I don't really pay that close attention to it because who knows, is one person's guess or another versus another. I don't know that the situation we're in right now with respect to interest rates is going to change much in the near future. I just don't see a dramatic change in that. I think the issues that caused it are too deep down in the economy that they're not likely to change. It's not like, oh, inflation's down to 3%. It's under 3% or whatever. Now the interest rates can start dropping. I don't think that's going to be the case. Or the Fed stop raising rates, or they even start dropping rates. There's more to it than that. And all you have to do is look at the yields in the 10-year treasuries. And, you know, the 10-year treasuries are the long-term debt. They're driving real estate interest rates, particularly in the commercial side. And why are they climbing so high? I mean, I've read good analysis. I'm not an economist, but I've read some good analysis that says they're from a number of reasons. The federal government borrowed a lot in the last quarter. They increased the debt. They borrowed, I think, three times what they've typically borrowed. And China is selling our treasuries. They're drawing down from their treasury ownership. They're not buying treasuries as much. This deal that Speaker McCarthy made in order to get to push the budget, the budget deal down the road a little, it cost him his speakership. There's no speaker in the House of Representatives. And this deal expires on November 17th. November 17th, they need another deal. They need to do something with the budget. And how are they going to do that without a speaker? And so all that is looming large on the economy, and those are affecting long-term investors, the 10-year treasuries. And when's that going to change? Yeah. That's a big question on our economy. So who knows?
That was a good breakdown, though, of kind of understanding how they're interrelated. Not a lot of people realize that commercial loans are based off of the 10-year treasury. That's good information to know. It doesn't function like a residential, you know, home loan. People think they kind of work in tangent together, and they're based off different things that way. So, we saw a real estate post. It was kind of tongue in cheek, but somebody posted this, you know, the hyper supply kind of real estate market cycle snapshot, and tried to make a post about it.
And they were like, it's talking about, you know, the recovery, expansion, hypersupply, recession. And it said, where are we in this graph? And then the first comment was, close your eyes and point at it. And it was just like, we don't know where we're at right now. You know, things are kind of everywhere based on kind of the data that's out there. It's a very abnormal time right now in real estate. But that was a funny graph.
Yeah. So more, and just to put a bow on that, even more reason to go to the fundamentals, to look at the fundamentals of a market, to look at the fundamentals of a deal, and to look at the fundamentals of real estate in general. You know, cash flow assets. There's a reason people are scrambling for those kinds of things. Nobody, not a lot of people I know are trying to buy land, okay? commercial development land. They want cash flow assets. So anyway, for what it's worth.
Yeah, we're going to jump into our smaller pockets segment. So, John, this is the part of the show where you tell us about a real estate deal that went wrong. So what went wrong? What was the outcome? And then what did you learn from it?
Okay. I'll go back a little ways. I bought it in an area that in general, the area was good. But I would say it was a little naive about underestimating the amount of repairs that were required. Mm. And I still don't have a huge amount of confidence in my ability to do that. What I can do is find good people to fill key roles. And I have good asset managers.
What kind of property was this, real quick?
It was an 11 unit.
Okay.
And I bought it with a partner. And we started having some repair issues, particularly with the roof. The roof was the worst part, but the roof, you know, this flat roof that we thought was okay was really not. A few leaks here and there, and the leaks were causing other issues. And then the tenants were complaining, and I didn't know it, but the city had gone through sort of a transition, a new leadership, and so new people in the city that were looking over properties like mine, and tenants complained to the city, and they went to the city,
man.
And the city came in and they looked around and they called out a whole bunch of stuff. Mm. And
probably more than just the roof.
Yes.
It's never just the problem.
It had to be done.
They're like, well, now that we're in here, oh my gosh.
Well, I mean, plus they have the ability to threaten fines and all that. And so there was an urgency. It wasn't like I said, no, you could live with a leaky ceiling. You could live with the water. I mean, that's not how I manage properties. I like to keep everything, completely functional and no issues. And I like to improve the lifestyles of my tenants.
Yeah.
And so this is, I definitely had my heart into this, but it was just came as a sudden surprise. And so essentially the end of the day, there was a lot of new expenses and had to bite the bullet. And I was thinking, well, what do I do with the property? Do I put it up for sale now? I mean, is it a distress property? And I just said, no, I'm not going to do that. I don't sell distressed properties. I spend the money to get the problem fixed. And I did. And it was such a right decision because not only were the tenants satisfied, but it was finding better tenants and getting rents up, and the market remained strong and was able to sell it. And we all did well on the property and it worked out well. And I take that lesson to heart that you have to do the right things. What I would do differently is don't let these things languish. You can't, if you're seeing signs of issues that particularly water issues. I mean, anybody who's owned real estate for a while knows that water is the bane of your existence. Anything that water related, you better get it fixed.
So can we talk numbers real quick? Maybe, do you remember what the purchase price was in that property?
It was in the low 500s, I think.
Okay. And then do you have any idea what your original kind of capital expenditure budget was on that property and kind of maybe what it ended up being by the time the city came through there and made you replace everything?
Yeah. It's funny. It had a good, what I thought was a good property inspector come in and looked around and gave me a complete list. You know, I come from an IT background and I'm just hyper list oriented, and I put things in spreadsheets and I just organized the heck out of that thing. And there was a nice list of all these that I went through with my naive estimating skills and put dollar values on these things that they found. And I came up with a number that it was like $10,000 or $15,000 to fix the issues that they found. And I was talking to my broker and said, well, okay, how do we go back to the seller now? And with our inspection response, and they said, why don't we just ask for $25,000? And I said, hey, that sounds great.
You're like, suckers. You know, I just got 10 grand more than it's going to take.
Yes, I know. Hot dog. And so, So that's what she did. The seller was quick to agree to it. And then we're off to the races. And I probably ended up spending $120,000 on these CapEx things.
Ooh, wow. Yeah. Which, you know, I know we're all like, ooh, but no, been there because, because here's the thing. First of all, it's always more, the issues you know about are more expensive than you think they're going to be. And then you have to make the assumption there's issues you don't know about, which didn't find its way into your underwriting or your reserves. And that's tough. Honestly, doing that phase of the deal analysis, I personally find one of the most difficult.
Yes.
And then because then sometimes the sellers are like, well, okay, I'll concede. We'll meet in the middle. Well, guess what? You got to figure out a way to supply the other half of that construction budget. And so it's going to come from returns. You're going to bring more equity into it, you know, something. That's tough, especially when the negotiation's on the table.
But part of the lesson is that you persevered. So, I mean, you didn't just give up, even though you're talking about a ton of capital expenditure, you know, way more than maybe you and your partner wanted to do. But you pushed through and you got to the other side and made a profit. So that's one of the cool things about real estate, one of the forgiving things about real estate is that we can make mistakes. And really, if the fundamentals of the deal are there, you can still end out on top.
Yeah, and that's to encourage people who feel maybe like they're stuck on the sidelines. Like, what if that scenario happens? Well, it can and will happen, but it doesn't mean that you lost money. You know, and you grew from it, right? Because now it's carried over to how you've treated other investments. It's that tuition.
Yes. You can't go into a deal like that or, you know, a $25 million deal, whatever the size happens to be, you can't go into it spending your last bit of money. You need to have access to additional resources to cover these kinds of things. There are unexpected challenges in real estate. As you become more experienced, and I've seen this with a lot of other syndicators and sponsors, and I've unfortunately become that way myself, is that you know to get the right advice and you know to plan for the unexpected and you know to have the resources available to do that. You're not going to throw up your hands and say, well, we're just not going to fix that or we're going to live with it. Some issue that's critical, if it's a safety or a water related issue, then you have no choice. You need to find the funds to do that kind of thing. And you should not have bought the property unless you could work out that particular issue.
That's true. We're going to go into our second show segment called Our Little Nugget. So, John, this is the part of our show where you impart to our listeners tried and true practice, could be a hack to the business that you carry with you every day and that they can apply to their businesses.
I would say one of the most important things is creating a good relationship with your property manager and understanding who they are and expecting and requiring accountability from your property manager. The first properties I bought were not too far down the road for me, and so I could go down and repair them, do all that stuff. When I sold them, bought properties maybe 3 hours away, I could still drive to the property. I could go there every week if I wanted, but I had property managers there. And I learned through that process that really I could own property anywhere in the US. And I've done that. I picked out other markets and I manage a property manager. And that's a difficult transition also. It's not just turn it over to them and not talk to them again for another 6 months. You are having regular conversations. You are requiring the information back from them, and you're replacing them if you need to. They're good people, really, by and large. They know what they're doing, but they don't always align with your principles. And it's, if there's a misalignment, you got to look internally first. What did I say or not do that caused them to misunderstand how not to communicate?
That's a humble approach to, I think, approach any relationship, is to say, because I think, you know, we're, as a human nature, it's easy, and the quick thing to do is to shift blame, right? Maybe I didn't set the right expectations, though. You know, maybe that's on me. Maybe I could have done something better. And even if it was on them, I think you are not overlooking an opportunity to grow in the way that you conduct yourself in business, which is important. So that's awesome. That's a great a great tip. What's been one of the greatest resources in your real estate investing career?
Well, in terms of people, a type of person, is that kind of what you're asking?
Yeah, or? It could be a person, yeah, podcast, book, could be a course you went to, could be a lesson, you know, somebody that mentored you. Yeah, it's kind of an open-ended question.
I mean, I'll plug the podcast world for sure. I listen to podcasts virtually every day, and I love sharing and providing my time and experience and knowledge and even mentor people. And the reason is because I listen to other people doing the same for me, and I've gotten a lot out of it. Podcasts, is one of them. Another one, I think, a resource people should not be hesitant to use is people in the mortgage broker industry. I talk to a lot of mortgage brokers. Certainly real estate brokers are somewhat like that, but real estate brokers seem a little bit different. Mortgage brokers are out and around and talk to a wide variety of different people. They're hearing about things, deals that work, properties that are maybe having problems, and things that people are doing, and they're often involved in deals, but they're a great resource, so knowledgeable and experienced. And can share insights that other people can't, and maybe even give you heads up about properties that might become available or other things that you think is current and relevant.
That's good. Yeah, that's a good thought. And just a comment on that, you know, it seems like, you know, being a real estate broker, company for us, I could see how some, maybe the brokers are a little more siloed. They're a little more isolated to the geography that the properties they're listing, where a mortgage broker, you can call somebody in New York and have them potentially underwrite a property in Kansas, you know?
Yeah.
So they have more of a network that would span geography and maybe create more value that way for you as an investor. How can people follow your success?
There are multiple ways. Certainly LinkedIn. I have a profile on LinkedIn, and there's a link tree with a whole bunch of other links. You can get to a book that I have about technology investors and problems they have investing in real estate, and maybe relate to some of them. You could go directly to learnaboutapartments.com and get to all of my content. My website is cardinaloak.com, but you can get there from any number of these different sources.
Awesome. Yeah, awesome. We'll put those notes
and maybe give
in
us
there.
A short snapshot of where you guys are at in your business right now, what you're going after, and what you're excited about.
Yes, I am going after larger apartment complexes in the Midwest. I like a number of different Midwest markets. Not so much Texas or Florida, Arizona. Those are red hot markets, and they're great to own property. And I've seen them as real competitive. I like Kansas, Missouri, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Kentucky, the major metros in those markets. And I have a lot of broker relationships in those markets that I maintain and try to find properties. I'm looking for properties, and certainly talking to partners, both general partners and limited partners, and love to meet people and set up time to understand how I can help them.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. Well, John, thank you. I appreciate you taking the time today to lend your experience in the real estate investing realm, provide some context, maybe some of what we're seeing now, relating that to, you know, past times and in the last, you know, decade and a half here for our listeners. So thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Garrett. Thank you, Seth. Really appreciate it. You guys have been fun, and I've enjoyed sharing a few of my experiences with you.
Awesome, man. Thank you. As always, excited that you joined us on another episode of the Reinvest Podcast. If this episode added to your tool belt or left you feeling inspired, go ahead and share it with a friend. Stay tuned every Tuesday for new episodes. And if you want to get in touch with us, go to our LinkedIn or Facebook profiles and shoot us a message. Move farther, reach higher, and grow deeper. See you next time.